From the Christian Research Institute in Charlotte, North Carolina, this is the Bible Answer Man broadcast with Hank Hanegraaff. We're on the air because truth matters and life matters more. On today's special edition of the Bible Answer Man, we pick up where we ended on our previous broadcast and present more of a pre-recorded episode of the Hank Unplugged podcast. Hank is talking with Jay Richards, a senior fellow at the Discovery Institute and co-author of The Price of Panic: How the Tyranny of Experts Turned a Pandemic into a Catastrophe. Let's now join Hank Hanegraaff and Professor Richards in their conversation.
Quite frankly, Jay, during this entire pandemic, I've flown across the country. I've continued living my life. I mean, I'm not reckless, but I don't want to be herded into a pen and stop living my life, stop interacting with my grandkids and my kids, and stop doing what I've been called to do in ministry. I think we can end up putting so much emphasis on fear that we stop living the lives that God has given us to live in the present.
I think that's exactly right. I honestly think, Hank, that part of the reason it was so easy to get us to comply is that we weren't told we needed to do this for our own good. We were told we needed to do it for others. And that's honestly why I think that public health emergencies are kind of going to be the tool of choice in the future for people that want to take away our basic liberties. Because, you know, I mean, we all heard the argument. Look, okay, Jay, maybe you'll be fine, but if you're asymptomatic and you're a carrier and you go to church, you might spread it to someone who's really vulnerable, right? And then they would get sick and maybe even die. And so you need to do this for them. Well, of course, that's true all the time. I mean, that's true when it comes to the flu. It's true when it comes to any infectious disease. And what we normally do is we tell people, okay, we're in the middle of flu and cold season, and we count on people to use their local knowledge to decide, okay, am I at risk? If so, how much risk am I willing to take? And that's how we sort of handle these things. And we actually think that actually the only kind of real benefit of social distancing that happened in the spring happened already as soon as people started hearing about the virus. We do different things based upon new information. We think people probably exercised more precaution based on their local knowledge. And then when the government-imposed lockdowns came down, they just made no difference so far as we could tell in looking at the data. And so this is the sort of irony. I mean, at least now we actually have the dates. We know when different states locked down. We have the case curves, we have the death and hospitalization curves, and so we can actually kind of run the test and say, okay, did the lockdowns make a difference? Unfortunately, here we are in December, and so many people, including public health officials, just aren't willing to really talk about, okay, what have we learned? The virtue of the Great Barrington Declaration, scientists and doctors, is they said, well, let's look at the data and focus on that and pivot based upon what we know. Let's not keep trying this thing that we know not only doesn't work, but it actually, I think, and many of them think, does more harm than good.
What is the relationship between lockdowns and the cost of lockdowns? I don't know whether I got this from your book or not. I just can't remember. But the cost of lockdowns in the United States alone is about $1 trillion per month. Yes. And we have just instituted in North Carolina, for example, a partial lockdown. So we know that lockdowns really don't work. And yet we also know that there is an extraordinary cost associated with lockdowns.
That's right. It's $1 trillion a month is the figure that we came up with. I can tell you there was a lot of blood, sweat, and tears coming up in that number because we wanted to figure out, okay, obviously the pandemic itself would have had a cost on its own. And so we needed to figure out what's the cost of the panic and in particular the lockdowns. And that is our estimate that the lockdowns cost the U.S. about $1 trillion every month. And that's not just dollars, that's lives and well-being, of course. The problem is that so many people tended to think that the question was between lives on one side and dollars on the other. I mean, Dr. Anthony Fauci said, well, I realize this is going to be an inconvenience, but we just have to do it. It's almost like they treated it as a one-sided risk, as if their lives are at stake only on one side. But the reality is their lives at stake either way. If millions of people lose their jobs, if millions of people aren't able to go in for cancer screenings, that costs lives too. And I'm just amazed at how many officially smart people just simply didn't think of that. I mean, Melinda Gates apparently just yesterday in an interview, and of course she and Bill Gates have been sort of big advocates for the lockdown, she said, you know, the one thing we really didn't count on or think about was kind of the economic consequences of this. Well, that's exactly what I was thinking of, because economics matters not because money matters. It matters because people matter. And doing things that just destroy the economy are going to cost people's lives. And that's honestly what persuaded me, okay, we got to write a book about this just so we can at least hopefully slow down or prevent us from making the same mistake twice.
You know, there are a lot of negative things said about the Gates, but one of the things I always think about when I think of them is what they're doing for the poor and the downtrodden. And in concert with what you just said, when the West locks down, it negatively affects the poorest of the poor around the globe.
That's right. I mean, in many ways, we spend most of the time in the book on just the domestic situation in the U.S. because we feel like that's what we have the most influence over. But if you look at the U.N. food program, so the irony here is the World Health Organization that sort of led the lockdown fever, part of the U.N. Well, the U.N. food program is the arm that looks at basically starvation and nutrition around the world. They estimate that just the shock to the global food supply chain because of the lockdowns could end up by the end of 2020. So we're there now, costing something like 300,000 extra deaths from starvation every single day, right? So that, and we're there now. Now, we won't know how accurate that is until 2021, but even if it's only 30,000, right, 30,000 excess deaths of starvation every single day just from a shock to the global food supply, that is to the global economy of food, that's a devastating cost. And this is not, you know, if you read news stories about this, they'll always talk about it as if it's a cost of the pandemic. It is not a cost of the pandemic. It's a cost of our response to the pandemic. And that's absolutely crucial to keep that distinction in mind.
You've already touched on this, but what's keeping us in a panic? Your book is titled The Price of Panic. But what is keeping us in the state of panic?
I think a lot of it is just incentives. I mean, I don't think that this is the result of millions of nefarious people wanting to harm their fellow human beings. I think most people sort of think they're doing the right thing. But I think part of it is that the media is so invested in this that at this point now to all of a sudden start making crucial distinctions. For instance, distinguishing positive tests, because we do 1.5 million tests every day, distinguishing that from cases that require hospitalization, right? Well, they should have been making that distinction all along. If they did it now, they'd be basically, it would be indicting the way they've reported this before. Starting to talk about the fact that the flu seems to have disappeared, probably because things that are being counted as COVID deaths now are actually, they're essentially cannibalizing what would have been other types of deaths in other years. So you can't really talk about that. They're sort of invested in it. And then, frankly, you've got lots of politicians who are all in on the lockdowns. And so it would look sort of strange for them to suddenly reverse course. And so you get this weird situation where you have lots of politicians claiming to be making decisions on the science, even though more and more of the scientists are speaking up and saying there's really no scientific justification for closing schools, for instance. Kids, there's very little evidence that they ever transmit this to each other. This idea of asymptomatic spread is probably not anything like what we thought it was. And even when kids get it, they're at much more risk of death from the flu than they are from COVID-19. That's just, you read that straight from the CDC numbers. And so at some point, something's got to give, because we can't stay in a panic state indefinitely. We can't do that physiologically. But I just think so many people in the media and in politics are so invested in this panic narrative, in this what we call panic porn, that they're just having a hard time kind of winding it down, unfortunately.
You think about narratives, and immediately comes to my mind the statement by Governor Andrew Cuomo, who said rather irrationally, if everything we do saves just one life, I'd be happy. So if we save one life by a lockdown, it's worth it. It's worth it, even if the collateral damage of a lockdown is far worse in terms of lost lives. Now, when I hear someone say something like that, I think, well, on the one hand, you can think he's nefarious. On the other hand, you can think, well, sorry for saying it this way, but he's just dumb.
I know. I honestly would pick that second hypothesis. I really don't think he realized what he was saying, because it was clear is that he's assuming, again, that this is a one-sided risk. So everything we do, if it saves one life, he's not imagining that there could be lives lost as a result of the response. He's assuming that there could only be lives lost as a result of the coronavirus. But of course, anyone that spent 10 seconds thinking about this and understands that every decision involves trade-offs is going to realize, look, if we basically clear out the hospital wards, we cancel all scheduled procedures and screenings in all the hospitals around the country, you know what? There are other sicknesses and forms of death that are going to continue going on. That policy itself is going to kill people. And so the rational public policy response is always going to say, okay, what are all the risks? How does this risk compare with that? And what's the kind of best way to reduce the risk from COVID-19 without creating other problems on the other side? But with Governor Cuomo, it was like there was just absolutely no thinking like this. And we're still in this stage of delusion. You know, he got this international Emmy a couple of weeks ago for communicating science on the airwaves, when in fact, not only did he not think clearly about it, but he's the one that, of course, ordered that nursing home patients that caught the coronavirus in hospitals got moved back into the nursing homes, which is literally what you would do if you wanted to kill people. It's not why he did that, of course, but you couldn't have done it any better if that had actually been the goal. And so there still really hasn't been a reckoning where people said, look, I made terrible mistakes, and the media said, okay, we misunderstood this. It still hasn't happened.
Don't go away. We'll be right back and rejoin Hank Hanegraaff's conversation with Professor Jay Richards. The human cost of the emergency response to COVID-19 has far outweighed the benefits. As the media fanned the flames of panic, government officials and a new elite of scientific experts ignored the established protocols for mitigating a dangerous disease. Instead, they shut down the world economy, closed every school, confined citizens to their homes, and threatened to enforce a regime of extreme social distancing indefinitely. And the American people complied without protest. We need to know what happened to keep it from ever happening again. Read The Price of Panic: How the Tyranny of Experts Turned a Pandemic into a Catastrophe by Douglas Axe, William Briggs, and Jay Richards. To receive your copy of The Price of Panic, call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support the Christian Research Institute's life-changing outreaches. 888-7000-CRI, or visit us at equip.org. The number of wolves surrounding the Christian flock is growing, and they relish nothing more than docile sheep utterly incapable of defending themselves. From militant secularists at home to militant Islamists abroad, the assaults on biblical Christianity are growing dangerously. But Christian Research Institute support team members aren't in favor of feeding these wolves. Instead, each day they're making possible an array of outreaches that defang these wolf packs with solid arguments and evidence that have stood the test of time. What's more, support team members are equipping themselves with CRI's Equipping Essentials, a hand-picked collection of the best apologetics tools around. Your selection of resources, along with a complimentary subscription to the Christian Research Journal, are just our way of saying thanks. To learn more about the benefits of membership, simply visit equip.org. Once again, that's equip.org.
For the first time in history, the world shut itself down by choice, fearful of a virus that wasn't well understood. The government ordered the closure of countless businesses, many never to return. Schools sent students home to be taught in front of a computer. Churches canceled worship services. Social distancing went from a non-word to a moral obligation overnight. We need to know what happened to keep it from ever happening again. In The Price of Panic, Professors Jay Richards, William Briggs, and Douglas Axe examine the worst panic-induced disaster in history, the COVID-19 pandemic. To receive your copy of The Price of Panic: How the Tyranny of Experts Turned a Pandemic into a Catastrophe, call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support the Christian Research Institute's life-changing outreaches. 888-7000-CRI, or visit us at equip.org.
An infinite God reduced to the size of a human embryo, the creator of time and space invading both in human form? Such is the mystery and the majesty of the Incarnation, supreme being condescending to become one of us. Perhaps nothing is more important than grasping the significance of the coming God in human flesh.
Without the life, death, and resurrection of the incarnate one who walked among us, our world would be unfathomably dark. To be equipped as a witness and to be inspired in your walk, you'll want to feast on Hank Hanegraaff's book, Incarnation, The Ultimate Self-Revelation of God. To receive your copy of Incarnation, simply call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support CRI's life-changing outreaches. Or visit equip.org. Equip.org. Let's rejoin Hank Hanegraaff and Professor Jay Richards as they continue their conversation.
Many powerful institutions, as you point out, push diversity, except when it comes to diversity of viewpoint. And so unless you go lockstep along with the herd, you are shouted down immediately. I mean, I've seen this over and over again during the course of this year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that's what's so odd about this, because very often, you know, we're talking about a so-called scientific consensus, but there was never anything like a consensus either on how deadly this virus is going to be or on the benefits of lockdowns. The scientists at the Great Barrington Declaration, many of them in March were saying, this is a really bad idea. This is untested. We need to look at this. But what happened, this is what we call the tyranny of experts, by the way. The problem isn't expertise. It's that you have these public health bureaucracies. You have it at the international level with the World Health Organization. And then, of course, you have every country has its own public health bureaucracy. And it's populated with public health officials that may be scientists, they may be medical doctors. The media treated them as if, well, if you're a public health official, then that's sort of like winning the gold medal of scientific expertise. And so whatever you said, that was the gospel with respect to the science. It didn't matter if there was a really smart, credentialed scientist, say, from Stanford that disagreed with you, because he was independent of the government. He wasn't an official in the public health bureaucracy. And that was the serious problem. The problem wasn't that the president has scientists advising him. It's that he has just a few scientists, and they all happen to work for the federal government and happen to have been inherited as part of the kind of permanent administrative state, when what the president and governors needed was really access to the full range of scientific opinion from the very beginning. And most of them didn't have that. I can say Governor DeSantis in Florida went out of his way to do that. He contacted scientists in Europe, and he figured out very quickly, okay, this is really dangerous to the elderly, especially in nursing homes. It's not so dangerous for children. And so they did a partial lockdown, and then they did focus protection. But he basically did what I think every politician in the future ought to do, which is make sure you have access to some scientists that are outside the government bureaucracy so that they're free to tell you exactly what they think. They're not bound by the incentives of being part of the government structure.
It's safe to say that your book, The Price of Panic, is a non-alarmist model that turns out to be right as we look back. But you were right in the wrong direction. What's the cost of being right, but in the wrong direction?
Well, this is the problem, and this is the kind of distinction we make in the book, is wrong in the right direction. You can get scientific accolades in the public health community, and in fact, you can continue to go on to greater and greater things. So Neil Ferguson, who is the head scientist, part of a team of 30 that developed this Imperial College London model, we go back over 20 years, he has never gotten a prediction right when it came to a pandemic. In fact, he's just been catastrophically wrong every single time. But the natural incentive, if you're in public health and you think about it, your job is to advise politicians, and you have to tell a prime minister, okay, this virus is just going to kill 100 people. Let's say you say that, and then it kills 10,000 people. Well, you're going to be looking for another job. But what if you say, well, it's going to kill 1 million people unless you, you know, sort of implement these draconian measures. And then you do, and then it kills a lot fewer people. First, people will say, well, good, I'm glad it wasn't as bad as we thought it would be. Or they'll say, oh, I'm sure glad we took your advice because we prevented all those deaths. In other words, nobody ever goes back and actually checks the original numbers. And that's what happened with Neil Ferguson, where there was SARS and swine flu or a bird flu, mad cow disease. Over and over again, he would get this wrong by many, many, many orders of magnitude, and he never suffered any consequences. On the other hand, if you're in the position like us, which is to say, okay, look, let's figure out how dangerous this bug actually is so that we know how best to respond to it. Well, you get attacked for being a conspiracy theorist and a hoaxer who doesn't believe it's a real virus. I mean, of course, we didn't think that, but that was essentially the response. And it was the response to scientists who said, actually, the infection fatality rate is so far as we could tell, that's not what it is. You were treated like a pariah. And that's just a very strange thing. So that basically alarmism sells and is beneficial both personally and in terms of media clicks. Non-alarmist attempts to try to calm people, it's not popular, especially when you're in the middle of a panic.
Is there any evidence that suggests that this virus was man-made?
We were perfectly open to that. I mean, I have to tell you, Hank, right at the beginning, the fact that the media said that can't be true and you're crazy if you think it made me think, okay, let's look into this because I don't trust the media. The original story was that it came from a wet market in Wuhan, in this large city in central China. I'd say looking at the details, looking at the sequence of the virus, we don't think there's any evidence that it was actually designed, because, of course, we think, you know, bioengineers could design a virus to be very deadly, but it's actually very similar to other coronaviruses we know of that are native to this particular type of bat. We know that they experiment on these bats at the Wuhan Institute of Virology. There were just basically a couple of changes that had to take place in order for it to pass to humans, but they're the kind of normal mutational changes that happen naturally. And so if it was designed, and you can't tell. It really looks very much like a natural virus that just made the jump from bats to humans. But we really do think it's much more likely that it came from that lab rather than from the wet market. That just seemed implausible to us. And just there are enough kind of indications between it being a bat virus, the Wuhan Institute of Virology being right there in the city, and then also the U.S. State Department just a couple of years ago issued a report saying they were worried about security protocols at the Wuhan Institute. And so we just think, you know, if we were going to bet, we think that it accidentally leaked from the Wuhan Institute of Virology.
Talk about social distancing. I was at Whole Foods yesterday, and you go down one aisle, and then you have to skip an aisle and go down the other aisle again, because if you go down the next aisle, you're going down the wrong way. You got to social distance. You got to stand 6 feet apart. Is there any science behind social distancing that is compelling?
Not very much, unfortunately. I mean, this was, again, a surprise to us, but we discovered this World Health Organization report, a sort of meta report, which is in 2019, October 2019, World Health Organization looked at really hundreds of scientific studies asking questions about masks, social distancing, the lockdowns, all these kind of non-pharmacological responses. And the conclusion of this World Health Organization report was that there's no solid evidence that any of these really make much difference. And then when you look at masks, at least masks as ordinary people wear them, that's the crucial point, they don't seem to make any difference. And in some cases, they might actually be counterproductive. What's really important to realize is that a lot of the things we're doing are based on the assumption that the main ways in which the virus spreads is kind of by sneezing and coughing. So sort of large, you know, spit basically coming out of our mouths when we cough. And so if you're wearing a surgical mask, that's going to stop a big globule of spit. That's really what it's designed for. So a surgeon that's operating on someone in case he sneezes, it's going to catch large particles, but it's not designed to catch aerosols, which are these really, really fine particles that also come out even when we breathe and when we sneeze, that can hang in the air for minutes or even hours. Those pass right through those surgical masks, just like smoke. I mean, they just really don't make any difference. And so if you're going to stop that, you need to be wearing N95 masks that are really tightly fitted around your face.
No facial hair.
No facial hair. Like I've got a little facial hair. It makes it completely ineffective because the air is just going to go right around the edge because it's hard to pull the air through that. And so that's why, you know, I actually had COVID-19. I tested positive and actually spent overnight in the hospital because my oxygen went down a little bit a few weeks ago. And I saw what the frontline workers are doing. They're wearing tightly fitted N95 masks, wearing goggles, face shields, gloves, the gloves over gowns. Some of them are wearing two masks that are tightly fitted. It's really quite inconvenient. And there's just no way that people living their lives are going to be able to do that. And so the stuff we're doing sort of might make some difference for the certain kind of a big cough in which you have a bunch of spit and somebody breathes it. It probably makes no difference for aerosol transmission, which we think is actually the main way in which this is transmitted. So unless you're going to spread people out in a kind of police state and force them to wear hazmat suits, we think that most of this, unfortunately, is hygiene theater and it's not making much difference.
We're on the cusp of a vaccine. I was reading in the paper this morning that the first vaccines may be implemented to the general populace this weekend. Is the vaccine rightly considered a shortcut to herd immunity? And maybe it's even good to talk about what herd immunity is. Maybe somebody doesn't know listening in.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the idea of herd immunity is, incidentally, it's not a strategy so much as just kind of an epidemiological fact that what happens with viruses like this is that once a certain percentage of the population has gotten the bug or is immune to it, then the bug has fewer vectors, right? Fewer ways to get transmitted around. And so when you vaccinate a large segment of the population, like the flu vaccine, people often think they're doing that just for themselves. Well, when you take a flu vaccine, it's only about 30% likely to actually immunize you. But by millions of us getting it, it actually speeds up herd immunity against that particular strain of virus for that year. And so really that's what a vaccine is. It's designed, unless it's 100% effective, one of its main uses is just to kind of speed up herd immunity. Now these vaccines, there's one by Moderna now and one by Pfizer that are kind of the first across the finish line. Of course, they haven't gone through the normal FDA testing. We've never developed a vaccine for a coronavirus in history that's passed the FDA. And so there's just so many unknowns that I think, you know, I'm super hopeful. I mean, I hope these really do have a 90 or 95% effectiveness rate. I really hope that they're sort of low cost to taking it. That would be terrific. But at the moment, we're getting this information from the press releases of the corporations who developed them. And so, you know, I'm just sort of suspending judgment at the moment.
We'll have to stop here for today's special edition of the Bible Answer Man broadcast. Join us again next time when we'll continue Hank Hanegraaff's conversation with Professor Jay Richards. Our daily commitment here at the Christian Research Institute is to defend the faith once for all delivered to the saints and equip believers to become true disciples of Jesus Christ. In appreciation for your vital gift to help strengthen and expand CRI's life-changing outreaches, Hank would like to send you the book, The Price of Panic: How the Tyranny of Experts Turned a Pandemic into a Catastrophe, by Douglas Axe, William Briggs, and Jay Richards. Call a resource consultant at 888-7000-CRI, 888-7000-CRI, or visit our website at equip.org. That's equip.org. You can also write CRI at Post Office Box 8500, Charlotte, North Carolina, zip code 28271. The preceding program was pre-recorded. The Bible Answer Man broadcast is funded by listeners like you. We're on the air because truth matters and life matters more.
For the first time in history, the world shut itself down by choice, fearful of a virus that wasn't well understood. The government ordered the closure of countless businesses, many never to return. Schools sent students home to be taught in front of a computer. Churches canceled worship services. Social distancing went from a non-word to a moral obligation overnight. We need to know what happened to keep it from ever happening again. In The Price of Panic, Professors Jay Richards, William Briggs, and Douglas Axe examine the worst panic-induced disaster in history, the COVID-19 pandemic. To receive your copy of The Price of Panic: How the Tyranny of Experts Turned a Pandemic into a Catastrophe, call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support the Christian Research Institute's life-changing outreaches. 888-7000-CRI or visit us at equip.org.